Welcome to the On The Money podcast with John Manyike.
Bra Eugene, excellent. How's it?
Good, thank you.
Maybe let's talk about where you come from. I know you are a Pretoria Tswane guy. Tell us more about your background.
I come from Mamelodi, P3, next to the graveyard. That's what it's famous for.
Were you sleeping at night?
Yeah, I always slept very well there. Oh. We even played at the graveyard. I only got scared of the graveyard when I grew up and I saw ghost stories. And I was like, how can't I have been living here all along?
Yeah,
so that's where I grew up.
You actually saw a ghost?
No. Only in the movies. Yeah, so that's where I grew up. I spent most of my childhood there, some of my adulthood there. And then, yeah, this is where I am now.
Family-wise, siblings?
Three other siblings. I'm the third out of the four. I'm not the last born. I'm not a middle child. I'm somewhere in between, confused.
Oh.
Yeah.
Any offsprings?
Yes. I've got one daughter, she just turned 15.
Okay, but then one?
Yes.
Oh, okay. You're working on...
We'll see how the economy goes.
It's an economic decision.
Yeah, I think also it's I've had this conversation before with a friend of mine. And I said, if you look at the TV shows that our generation watched, because
yeah.
I mean, I'm 42 this year. So I say, if you look at the shows that Girlfriends, Living Single, it was not promoting families.
Yeah.
And when I drive around Four Ways or Centurion, I can see that generation.
Yes.
Of mostly single women or single men, people that don't live with their children and are pursuing their single life. And in my head, I always think they're in their late 20s or early 30s. And I find out they're in their 40s. You know, they're still thinking, okay, maybe if I can afford a four-bedroom, a five-bedroom, then I can have children.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, it's a generational thing, you know. And if there was something I could do differently, is I would have more children earlier. Because now at 42, I see the importance of it, you know. Yeah. The work-life balance, it gives you a purpose, you know, because it's not all about work.
Bra Eugene, you took a long break from the public domain. I mean, you're a multi-talented entertainer.
So they say.
the fact that you do stand-up comedy, you produce, I mean, you've got different hats. To take a long break of about 5 years, I mean, because I'm sure people are wondering, it must have taken a lot out of you.
Absolutely, but it was totally necessary. You know, there was a lot going on at the time. And I've spoken about this before. I said the loss of my son, who was 3 months old at the time, only hit me a year after he had passed on that what had happened, you know. So I needed to take a break because I understood easily that if I don't take a break, I'm going to fall apart.
Yeah.
But breaks in our industry are very expensive.
That's true.
So, but I decided I had to do it. I moved with my daughter to PE. We lived by the beach for over a year, and I came back to Gauteng again, and I started working again. So I'm grateful that I could come back and work.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful that I could take the time off.
Yeah.
Off of work, off of the pressure, off of the expectations, and take care of myself and come back the way I was.
I would say that's very bold and courageous. But also wise, because you have to listen to your body. You need to know yourself and your limits to the extent where you say, you know what, I'm taking that break. But as you say, you know, in your industry, breaks are expensive. I mean, you're a freelancer. If you don't work, there's no income. I mean, if you have a 9-to-5, I mean, you go through depression. Sometimes they've got sick leave. They can give you
extended
leave.
No,
cheap. Oh, you are playing 9-to-5. But then, of course, I mean, you do have a limit in terms of what you can earn if you're doing a 9-to-5.
Yeah.
And with you, with a multiple heads. But I'm interested in understanding, during that extended break, the necessary one, as you put it, how did you handle finances at that time and when there's no income? Did you have savings, a buffer of some sort to be able to sustain you for that 5 years? How did you do that?
I had savings, but also I realized that I was trapped in a cycle of working so I can pay for things that I had. So I always say to people who grew up with nothing, they work hard so they can have something. And once you have things, then the things own you now. Now I have to work to pay these things. So for example, if my debt a month, my bills are 80,000 rand, so it means I have to make over 100,000 rand to pay my bills. Right. But if I cut off all those bills, the 80,000 rand, it means I'm paying myself 80,000 rand. Does it make sense? It means I'm paying myself. So if I take away the house, the car, things that cost me 80,000 rand.
Yes, the money that comes to you.
Yeah, so if I don't go to work, it means I'm paying myself 80,000 rand not to deal with the stress.
Yeah.
A lot of us, and especially people of color, we don't know how to surrender to debt, to do voluntary surrender to things that we've bought, especially big things, because they're attached to our emotions, they're attached to our growth, they're attached to perceptions and how people see us. So that's a conversation that I had with myself before I embarked on this journey. I looked at myself and I thought to myself, 60,000 rand a month on things that I don't use every day, a house here and another house there and a car here. I don't need all these three things. What can I get rid of so I can pay me to take care of myself? And I started with that. And then I realized that my savings could carry me. And I was able to do a lot of online work as well, which has nothing to do with comedy, which was a lot of corporate work. I wrote a couple of programs for insurance companies that I was able to do training for them and license the IP. So I was happy that I could do that.
Yeah.
But I would have never been able to do that had I not cut off the debt that I had, had I not taken time off of my job as an entertainer, and had I not had savings or intellectual property to actually sell.
You mentioned something profound there. Were there specific things that you had to give up, that you had to surrender to try and
become lean? The one big thing was my car that I loved a lot. And the other thing was my other house that I loved a lot as well. Yeah. But I realized after I bought the house that as a black person, you always get taught, work hard and then buy a house. Then no one tells you need to maintain this house. And no one tells you that the average person who works at a job has got 3 strikes before they get fired. So if you mess up 3 times, you're gone, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So your contract maybe averages 5 years and can be renewed 5 years, 5 years. Your bond is 23 years or 25 years, average. In most cases, my job, if I work in a corporate environment or if I have a contract to do a campaign with whoever, would never outlive the debt that I have.
Yeah.
So that's the trap that I found myself. And we get trapped into the a lie of a big deposit as well. So I bought an expensive house and then I was convinced by the bank to pay a big deposit.
Yeah.
Then when I did calculations, I realized that the deposit that I paid for the house could have actually been installments for the house for 3 years. So I could have actually, with the original debt, I could have lived in the house 3 years without paying installment, and I'd taken the deposit and used it as installment over the years. But no one told me that.
Yeah.
So that's the part of financial literacy where I feel like, as people of color, we're left behind of all those conversations, big deposits for things that we know that we won't keep forever. If someone told me that I won't keep the house for 25 years, I would have never put that much money into the house in the first place.
Yeah.
So I had a chance at least 5 years in to correct my mistake, and I voluntarily surrendered it, and I had shortfall to pay, and the shortfall was nothing compared to what I would have had to pay in the long run.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that I was brave enough to have those decisions made by myself. I'm happier for it.
I think for the benefit of somebody who still doesn't understand the concept of voluntary surrender, maybe just walk us through there. What does this mean when you say voluntary surrender a car or property?
Okay, I might be wrong, but it's provided for in the National Credit Act.
Yeah.
If you take out debt, debt has insurance that in case you die or in case you're disabled, the insurance will pay for the debt and you're not liable for it anymore. But there's also a provision for in case you can't pay or maintain the debt. Instead of getting yourself into the credit bureau or flagged, you go to a lender and you say to them, look, I can't do this anymore. And then they say, okay, sharp, we'll take the car. And then whatever we can sell the car for, we will sell it. We'll find a fair price because also we're trying to make money.
Yeah.
And you pay for the shortfall.
Yeah.
So that's what I did with both of those big ticket items that I had. Is I did voluntary surrender and then the banks were like, okay, we'll see what we can do. And then later on you get a note that says you owe us this much and then you pay that much and then you guys are clear.
You have to be big mentally to be able to do that because there are people who hold on to things because they're worried that, what will people say if suddenly I don't have this big house that they saw me take pictures and posting on Instagram? Mm. I don't have this car that I used to drive. And how do you overcome that mental challenge, you know, of having to make peace that, you know what, I'm letting go of this thing, regardless of what people will say?
Sure, I think the universe curated it for me. I always say to people, I face the one thing that people fear the most, which is losing a loved one, you know, or losing a child. So I realized I have no control over anything. And I think after I've lost that and it wasn't in my powers, we had medical aid, we had a great house, we were living down the road from a hospital, but it still happened. So I realized that I have no control, I have no power, so I have to come to terms with loss. I'm a person now, since 6 years ago, when the loss happened, that I'm okay with loss, you know, I make peace with it. When things don't work out, I move on and I try something else, and I try to be happy every day. Because had I known that the 3 months is all I had, I would have had so much fun, you know. There's people who have houses with swimming pools that they don't swim in. There's people who have 3 cars that they don't drive. There's people that have 6 kids that they don't go to soccer matches, Zabo, or see them play. So once I realized how precious time was and the things that we hold on to that delay us in having fun and finding ourselves and enjoying people around us, then I realized that all of these things were just things that I bought because of one of fear, expectation, and insecurities. And once that happened, for me, there was nothing else really that I was scared of. I'm not scared anymore. I try things, and if they fail, I continue with life.
Yeah. I mean, what you just said just highlights the fact that the things we own don't define our identity or who we are.
At all.
So it's not my car, my house that defines my identity. So whether I have it or not, I'm still Eugene Koza.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I also credit that to my mom as well. She always raised us to believe that we are who we are, and what people think of us is neither here nor there, you know. That confidence only kicked in when I really needed it, not when I was young, and my friends were leading me astray and saying, hey, let's go play in another section and we come back in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, that confidence was not there then.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then when I was older, like in my mid-30s, that actually kicked in. And I was remembering what she taught me. It only takes those kind of moments to realize that, you know, some people are your friends for a season and some people are your friends for a reason. And you can't always blame them or rely on them because everyone is on their own journey. So when things like that happened, I learned to just rely on myself and let go and move on.
The loss of a loved one can have devastating impact emotionally, but very often we ignore the impact financially. What were some of your financial lessons from your loss?
That death is expensive in many ways. Like you said, it doesn't only cater for the funeral itself. It caters for the months or perhaps the years that you won't be able to work because you're not emotionally okay. And I think that's the part where insurance doesn't cover. You know, I've seen funeral plan, I've seen life cover. But then in the life cover there's no little document that says, yeah, also make provision for cancelling, long-term cancelling.
Yeah.
Because a loss of a loved one is forever. You just get better. It doesn't go away.
Yeah.
So what about people that needed more time than me? What about people that committed suicide, you know, because they couldn't deal with the loss of a loved one because they blame themselves? So you need money to survive a lot of things. And I feel like cancelling is one of those things where I'm happy I could afford it because I went through it for a couple of years, and it's not cheap at all, you know. I'm glad that I could afford it, but I can understand or I can sympathize with people that couldn't afford to take a year, a month, or even a week off to mourn and process what was going on and rationalize it and so that they can move on and be around for their other kids.
Given your journey, what sort of professionals or experts did you surround yourself with?
YouTube. You know, 10 years ago, when people spoke about open source learning, you know, you used to see those videos from China of people going to buy parts and make their own phones. And we used to laugh at that because we never understood what open source learning was. YouTube is the biggest tool that we have right now. I think it surpasses mainstream television. It even surpasses streaming. It's even in Africa, it's a threat to television and streaming. That's how much people are using YouTube. You can find out everything, how to bake a cake, how to make a bomb, how to deal with loss, how to fix your own Ferrari if you have one or buy a scrapped one. So I find that YouTube became a wealth of knowledge for me, and especially during lockdown, because I could rely on that to type in a question and I could find dozens of experts. Even people who've just gone through it just want to find out how they could deal with things. And I found that open source learning is my go-to even now.
But technically, from what I'm hearing, it does not necessarily mean replacing experts. Because
at all.
The content on YouTube that you're talking about is actually experts talking on a specific subject that they are a subject matter expert on.
So a professional for me, face-to-face, it came to that point. So after watching videos on YouTube about how to deal with a situation, I knew I needed an expert, someone to sit with face-to-face. Then I sat with my psychologist at the time, and then we had conversations over 2 years, like I said, of therapy that helped me to get to where I was.
Yeah.
But then she showed me things that I wouldn't have seen by myself. Or I would have eventually saw them, but then it would have taken longer.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that I had access to a professional at least.
I think another powerful thing from what I'm hearing is that you're doing a homework on whatever topic. So by the time you meet with an expert, you're not starting from zero.
Yeah, you know exactly what you want.
Yeah.
Conversation with financial advisors for me, I was informed about what I read or what I've seen on video. I don't need to make a phone call anymore. Or I don't need to have a brochure. I can just go on YouTube and listen to a topic. And then when I meet with a financial advisor, I can say, tell me about my finances and also advise me. Because you know those two jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they're not mutually exclusive. So you always say, advise me here. And then, tell me about my finances. Yeah. So I go prepared in most cases because I do a little bit of research first. And I see what other experts feel and think about the topic. And then I get there and then I know exactly what I want and they can guide me to say, no, this is not good for you. And I wish I had that 10 years ago, 15 years ago when I bought my first house and my second house and got myself into debt and then paid huge amounts of deposit. If I knew what I know now, I wouldn't have made those mistakes and I would have made better investments.
Okay. Have you ever used your personal experience as material for your routine, whether it's a stand-up comedian or as an actor or in the work that you produce?
I do. But I have a problem with being self-indulgent. Right now, I'm writing a book. I've just been offered a publishing deal. I'm writing a book. And I'm stuck in the first half of the book because I feel like it's too self-indulgent, you know? I feel like there's other people who've gone through far worse than I have or more than I have that can speak expertly about any topic that I feel like talking about. But I also understand that my own voice is unique as well. I'm learning that. This is the chapter I'm learning in my life in 2023, that my experiences matter and they're worth sharing as well. So I am learning now that, okay, I can use myself, but in comedy, I hardly ever use myself. I use other people that I see, you know, as a way of avoiding dealing with things myself, because people make the mistake of thinking that comedians are very open-minded, and we're not.
Yeah.
We're self-critical, and then we like looking at other people and going, bona wen.
Yeah. What were your biggest financial lessons from the pandemic?
That when it all comes down to it, everything costs money. To move around costs money. To do this thing and that costs money. People with money are just privileged enough to avoid people like us who don't have that much money. During the pandemic, we all had to go to the store at certain times. So rich and poor, middle class and lower class, we met at the same time buying eggs and cooking oil. So if you didn't have electricity at your house, you needed money to pay for the electricity. And financially, I've learned that you cannot rely on one source to make money. I also realized that hard labor jobs are soon going to be a thing of the past. Like, I look at the strike in Tshwane, for example, and I go, if it is your job as a technician to wire houses so that they can have electricity, how long before people don't need houses to be wired anymore so that they can be electricity? So those hard labor jobs taught me a lot. Like I said, also the program that I wrote also taught me through technology that people can do a training course without being in the building. So it's a threat that's facing everybody, me or someone who owns that gigantic building, to think, do you actually need people to be inside there to justify the cost of having this gigantic property? So I'm learning that in a microscopic level. And I'm saying creating and owning intellectual property that can survive any pandemic is the way to go. And that's been my quest ever since.
How are you going about building a financial legacy?
I think my biggest concern right now is how can I help other people realize that there are sources of income that were hidden from us?
Yeah.
Not by anybody, but just by the system or by where we found ourselves geographically and also based on the education that we have and the access to information that we have. That's my biggest bone to pick with the world right now. And I'm very big on podcasts. That's why I was excited when I heard about this podcast. And I'm like, anywhere where there's a podcast, Mina, point me there.
Yeah.
Because I feel like before, you would need to go to a TV station as Old Mutual and buy an advert to put out this message.
Yeah.
Now you can use the environment that you have. You can use experts that you know to take the information out there to everybody in a palatable manner, in a way that doesn't feel forced, in a way that they can consume at their own time and luxury, and also choose what to listen to and what not to listen to. So I am more obsessed with making information available to people and letting South Africans know that broadcasting their stories is actually the way to go right now, you know, and you can make money from it. You make millions of dollars in the US telling us about how they feel. But we don't do the same here in this country. We don't tell people all over the world about how we feel. And then people don't watch us and then they don't know. And then we wonder why people are so ignorant about the world.
Yeah.
So I want people to know that that's my legacy. I wish for most young people to understand that their stories are valuable and that technology and open source media is out there for them and new media is out there for them to carve a living. You don't have to go study 7 years to be an engineer to earn 80,000 rand anymore. You can earn 80,000 rand a day from saying what you want to say.
I think that's so big, what you just said there, you know, because you're focusing on how you empower others, you know, but people sometimes forget that when you're giving to others, the one who waters gets watered. It doesn't mean you're becoming poorer by pouring into others. You can actually make money by empowering others. But although your ultimate goal is not really about making profit out of it, but which takes me to my next question. I mean, what projects are you working on now?
I am currently turning my last stand-up show into a book. And I have pitched and created a few podcasts that are going to be hitting the airwaves soon, mine included over there. And there's one that I did during the pandemic as well. My goal right now is just to have the most IP I can have under my belt and see other people flourishing and having a good time doing it. You know, I feel like after the pandemic, we all deserve to have a good time.
Yeah.
Like, life is so short. We lost people in a matter of weeks sometimes that we saw them just the other day.
Yeah.
You know, so I wish people could just realize that there's more avenues to make a living out there and you can maximize on your time by spending time with your family and creating other avenues and empowering people. And I feel so rewarded because in the last year or so, I've been able to travel the world. I've been able to meet with other people. I mean, in my podcast, I have 24 episodes under my belt, and none of the guests that I've had are South African. All of them are Hollywood actors or directors or producers or creators. Those are people that were generous enough to give their time when we have a 6 hour, sometimes an 8 hour time difference to me, and they didn't even know me. So I feel like that lesson that I learned there, I'm trying to do the same now. I gave up my time freely, and I'm so surprised at how many people are giving their time for me so freely. And I'm able to earn far more than what I was able to earn when I was too focused on comedy. And I wish I knew all of this earlier.
What would your advice be to anyone who wants to make a difference in the world in their area of interest, given their talents?
Just try. You know, just try. I was encouraged that when I was young, and I never understood. My mom would say, try. Try it again. Yeah. I failed. You're not failing. Try. And try it again. So I impart that to my daughter, and I can see how she tries. And then she fails, and then she tries again. Next time, she doesn't have to do it again. People must just try. The thing that you love the most is the thing that you're meant to do. Sometimes you have a job just in between, just to carry you through, but it should exactly be that. When your job gives you 5-year contract, look at the 5 years as time that they're borrowing you to be financially stable so that you can be brave enough to do what you really want to do.
Yeah.
Even in radio, you have a 5-year contract, but it's actually every 30 days for the next 5 years that they're going, do we like you? Do you like us? Do we like you? Do you like us? So I wish people who are everywhere in these buildings, who are working in companies and they feel aggrieved, instead of feeling aggrieved and angry in traffic or angry at other people, just use the time to think about what you love the most, what you're passionate about, something that you would do for free. That is your go-to. So start something small, register a company, Google, go on YouTube, look at what you can do. Start writing, start cooking, doing other people's hair. Those small little things have a way of making people happy. And I'm on this happiness campaign. I just want people to spread more happiness, you know? So I think once we can do that, we can see this economy growing. The gig economy is no longer a gig economy.
Yeah.
It's a real, real economy. People are making millions of rands doing what they love. So I think now is the time. The window's going to close. I feel like the pandemic put us on an equal footing with the rest of the world when it comes to things that happen on the internet or things that are IP-driven. As time goes on, it's going to be saturated and the window's going to close. So I wish everybody could just take advantage of the data that they have and the smartphones that they have and the laptops that they have and the opportunity that they have in the buildings that they work in and create something for themselves.
Tata Nugent, they say dynamite comes in small packages.
What do you say, Samagali?
You know, so there's a reason why you're not a giant.
But you are a giant.
You
Thank
know?
You so much.
But it's really been wonderful having you here. And I trust anyone who's watching or listening to this podcast will pick up some nuggets in terms of how they navigate their financial journey.
Now, I'd like to say, I think first time I met you was exactly a year ago in a conference that your company was hosting. And I was one of the people that said, but new media, you guys are not doing anything about new media. And look at you now, you're already on the process of doing it and you've taken it so far. And it's been over a year that you've been doing this. So congratulations. I think I'm very proud of you. And anytime you want to have me, I'm here for you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Subscribe to the Old Mutual On The Money YouTube channel and become a master with your finances.
Old Mutual. Do great things every day. Old Mutual Life Assurance Company, SA Limited, is a licensed FSP and life insurer.